Good afternoon, and you're probably wondering, how in the world did this person get in this room? To boot, she's a lawyer, so why is she here? And the reason I want to say that is that there's a lot of connectivity between the work that you're doing from the clinical to the screening to the research phase as it relates back in full circle to the human. And as I listened to the presentations before me, there were spot-on matches that are important because we've got to start tying the work that you're doing with the people and the conditions in which they're living. And it's important to you not only because it's going to make better outcomes for the community, but also it's going to increase the ability of your work to get it done. So I'm going to give you a really quick run through of some initiatives and some reasons of why this is important. And hopefully when I'm done with this talk, you'll think, well, this was not totally crazy. So what I want to do is try to take wherever you're sitting, and Laura Fleming's here, and Jean is here. So we've got great people who already know this. And so I know I'm preaching to the choir. It's try to think of three different axles or axi or axes that you can work on. One is this notion of relationships. The medically underserved that you work with are also environmentally overburdened, who are also historically underrepresented. Same people, a lot of money being put into these communities, and we still, at 20 healthy people, 2020, still suffer from the same problems. So I wanted to be really thinking about these potential relationships. The other is to think about aligning some issues associated with environmental justice to vision care. It's spot on, connections are there. It's not hypothetical. And finally, I just want to do a real quick run through some what I think are some really exciting federal family initiatives that are about healthy and sustainable communities. And as we already know, diabetes, the population you're affecting, minorities, low-income people of color, is very vital to this whole point. So the notion here, again, the transformational thinking, is that given the burdens that we're facing with the communities, and whether you talk about diabetic retinopathy, whether you're talking about asthma, whatever conditions, they're just dwarfing what seems like our capacity to deal with them in a time where resources are shrinking. So we can't just be creative in the work that we're doing. We have to be really transformational. And everyone that spoke before me is already doing transformational work. So I know that we're making progress in that regard. But as you think of these spheres of social determinants, the statistics, the data, with the people and what they're living with. You know, do they have access to grocery stores or do they only have access to fast food restaurants? When we think about federally qualified health centers, they're put into a system of policies and programs. How do you think we're expanding all these health centers? $11 billion under the Affordable Care Act. That's a policy decision. So try to reorient your thinking and think of this as a merry-go-round and think of all the storms on the East Coast and shake your head up and then come back down and we'll come up with more solutions. So within that, I think the first step, and it's stunning to me how often I run into people who are experts in the clinical care arena and really haven't had the opportunity to think outside their office to say, well, what are some of the other causes for why the people are coming into my office? And when you talk about vision and eye disease and the environment, there's clear relationships. Maybe it's causal, maybe it's association, but nevertheless, they're together. With endocrine disruptors coming from dioxins, PM2.5, air pollution coming from L.A., you know, people know, not just L.A., think of California, where it's serious air pollution problems. Relationships between herbicide and cataracts, also dealing with some, there were some epidemiologic studies presented today, I think, dealing with refractive era, macular degeneration and dioxins, and glaucoma. So again, it's not hypothetical, the relationships are there, so as your patients are coming in, and I think, David, you talked about primary prevention, which is key for diabetic retinopathy. Well, let's think about primary prevention for diabetes to begin with, which I will be talking about later on. So again, continuing, and I'm running really fast because we don't have a lot of time, it's important to understand this concept of environmental justice. Back in the last millennium when the Environmental Justice Executive Order was signed, it was about increasing, communities that had that lived next to power plants or refineries and all sorts of polluting facilities. So it was really about trying to reduce exposure by reducing the sources of pollution. But it was also the recognition that an individual is not just subject to one polluting source at a time. There could be multiple sources, transportation, so on and so forth. There's also the recognition that many of these communities don't have public water supply systems that are meeting the Safe Drinking Water Act standards, or they may not have access to health care, things that, that many of you are working on. But that's a key part of environmental injustice. Recognition of susceptible populations. We all oftentimes think of children, but it could be medically people who are ill, other reasons which make them susceptible. Many of the populations have unique exposure pathways. The concept of subsistence fishing, people who are relying, whether it's fish, whether it's birds that eat the fish, are getting increased rates of exposure to contaminants because of their conditions in which they live. Another point is, again, the ability to participate in the decisions which affect their lives. Many times they don't even speak English. We have an executive order on low English proficiency, which I think can maybe help advance some of the work that you're doing. The seventh factor, which is really receiving importance now, is the whole concept of psychosocial stressors, that when you put all this together, that's an additional assault to your body. And these are things that as you're doing your research, as you're designing your studies, not only are they important for understanding the nature of the problem, but they can also help come up with solutions to overcoming some of the barriers that you're facing. So again, the notion is, you know about the relationship. So the second part is this transformational thinking. And again, it's taking the work that you're doing, whether it's vision care or maybe it's another type of healthcare issue affecting the population that you serve, low-income minority, which is also the environmental justice population, but really paying attention to what's happening in their world besides what brought them to you in the first place. And here I talk about environmental policies, but it's sustainability policies. There's transportation policies. There's housing policies. Tons of interest, tons of effort. Things are really changing at the federal level to make life better and helping sustainable communities, but too often we have silos, as we've heard our leadership of the APHA talk about. So that's part of what this is all about. I always like to think of the notion of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention from a public health perspective is the perfect match with what we're trying to do with environmental justice and sustainable actions. You know, the notion that you want to prevent it in the first place, well, there's a lot of work with pollution prevention and creating green zones where you take the polluting facilities out of where people are living and put it elsewhere. The notion of, well, once you've got the disease, what do you do about the symptoms? That's, you know, our whole regulatory structure with permitting and looking at the transportation options. Do you build a road? Do you provide public transportation, a light rail? So things are underway in that arena. And then finally, when all else fails, trying to make things better, you've got the issue of contaminated sites. Whether it's a Superfund site or it's a brownfield site, many of the communities, many of the people in your population base that we heard from the previous presenters are exposed to tons of pollution from multiple sources, and that's a factor that's going to affect the outcome, and we need to be mindful of that. So like I said, be thinking about your public health prevention paradigm and think of how that relates to the place where people live, work, play, and pray. Then the next point in terms of this alignment, it's always refreshing when the communities that we're trying to serve, people who may have a third grade education, really get it and get it sometimes before we do. One of the early initiatives of the administration was the National Conversation on Public Health and Chemical Exposures and a number of different working groups. And I happen to serve on the Serving Communities Working Group, which had a good array of your healthcare providers, from optometrists, from physicians to nurses, other primary care providers, as well as community-based organizations. And they recognized in this whole sphere of information and concern about toxic substances that access to health and access to health care were front and center. And they wanted not just access to health care, but they wanted comprehensive health care with a whole range of services, and really put forth the notion that when we're trying to deal with access to health care, let's try to put all of these components together, and I'll talk about some successes, but like I said, this was a community-based effort that got it right back in 2009. What I want to do now is just really, and how am I doing on time, because I'm speeding.
You have 6 minutes and 11 seconds.
Good, okay, well I will slow down a bit, because what I want to do is help you understand the architecture that the administration has put forth, again, with the message that healthy and sustainable communities need to be created for all communities, including the disadvantaged, and that's going to require alignment of the policies, whether it's health policies, transportation policies, housing policies, environmental policies. And one of the major vehicles which is also provides an important roadmap, is what we call the Federal Interagency Working Group on Environmental Justice. Again, realizing environmental justice is about public health, essentially. There are 17 different federal agencies that have signed on to the Memorandum of Understanding. It was resurrected at the principal's level, so you have the agency heads on down. Secretary Sebelius has been a key leader. Our agency administrator at EPA has been, so on and so forth. But there are 17 federal agencies that have done environmental justice strategies, and that's a roadmap, whether it's a roadmap like HHS's, which has as one of its main parts services and clinical care, which may provide information on partners and assets that you can tap into, to Department of Transportation, Veterans Administration, General Services Administration, Department of Defense. I know we have somebody from the Department of the Navy here. So like I said, this is important to know. The documents, you know, comparatively speaking, aren't that long. You can read them, but find out where you can make some alignments. An interesting point, I happen to chair the National Environmental Policy Act Committee, and that's a forward planning statute that tries to facilitate advanced thinking on the impacts of projects that the federal government is supporting. It could include funding projects, it could include programmatic projects, it can include facilities. But health is required to be considered by the statute, and that's the weakest link in this whole arena. So again, as you're thinking about your research projects, again, there may be data sources. Some of these efforts can benefit from what you're doing, and maybe you can benefit from that. But like I said, the IWG on environmental justice is a very well-supported and I think a very important agency initiative. Now, another one that was created in the beginning of this administration, and I think it's very relevant and growing importance, is the Housing and Urban Development, Department of Transportation, Environmental Protection Agency Partnership for Sustainable Communities. And again, it was this recognition that decisions about transportation and housing should be taken into light of some of the environmental decisions, so that you want this whole system to work together. A big focus has been on creating options and opportunities for transportation. Let's get people out of the cars. Let's get them into sidewalks and public transportation. It's very much related to the whole issue of obesity and chronic diseases, which ultimately is related to diabetes as well. It has guiding principles. Again, as I mentioned, transportation choices, affordable housing. There's the recognition that you want to support existing communities and the assets that they bring and not just tie it to creating new communities elsewhere. But like I said, this is a very powerful partnership, because what they wanted to do is align the funding, the programs, and the policies together. And this is a map of where funding and different types of assistance are being provided around the country. And to give you an order of magnitude, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, our office provided a $100,000 grant to a community that was 93% African American, you know, 90-plus percentage low income. Well, then Housing and Urban Development came in with a $2.5 million grant. Well, $100,000, $2.5 million. Well, then the Department of Transportation came in with an $11 million grant. Whoa, that's great. Well, then guess what? The Department of Education came in with a $14 million Gear Up grant. And the circle was closed, because ours was about the low-income minority population, including the youth, and doing training and things such as sewage treatment certification. Well, the Department of Education was to get the disadvantaged youth looking at seventh grade on, career-bound and college-ready. So it was a way where in Bridgeport the work organically took place to work together. It wasn't proactive, but that's an example, I think, of where there's assets here in your communities that you can perhaps be tapping into. Another very important strategy that's been mentioned several times throughout this conference, which to me is incredibly exciting, is the National Prevention Strategy coming out of the Affordable Care Act. One more time, you have 17 different federal agencies that are behind prevention. Ironically, you have the National Prevention Strategy, 17 agencies. You have the IWG with 17 agencies. Are they working together? Well, starting now. But we're trying to get them in alignment, again, because it is about capacity. The three primary areas, one is to promote prevention and health in all decision-making, especially for those agencies that don't normally think they're doing health. Again, it's a great opportunity to leverage not just the expertise that y'all have and the information on your project, but where can you find allies and where can you push other federal agencies to do what you want to do. A lot of talk on tobacco-free environments, and again, this whole issue of healthy, affordable food is fundamentally tied to diabetes and access to safe sources of food. There is an action plan that was produced this year, in the summer of this year, every year there's a requirement to report to Congress so you can kind of track what they're doing. There are 200 action plans within the federal agencies. Again, 17 different federal agencies, so you could take a look at what that action plan is and find where there is alliances and allegiances is what you're trying to do. Again, here's a great example of where having given a similar talk over the number of years, we've got some success stories where we have a, it's a $26 million health center that was created in, Indiana or Illinois, or where is this? Somewhere. But the bottom line is it cost them, I'll have it there, it's a $26 million health center, but they used almost $4 million of Brownfield's tax credits. Think of that, almost 10% of their budget was given to them because they redeveloped this particular, they put this particular facility on a redeveloped, remediated brownfield. So it's an example of where you can take funding from the environmental arena and find out whatever it is that you want to do and use some of the properties, either at low to no cost with some tax credits to expand the scope of what you're trying to do. Right now, we're actually working with a number of academic institutions trying to create hubs within disadvantaged neighborhoods for mental health care using gas stations and redeveloped gas stations. So again, it's a really exciting partnership to get some place-based work going on. And with that, I like to just close with this slide, and I think I'm landing my plane on time, is that we've all heard about the adage of taking lemons and making lemonade. Well, we don't have the ability just to survive off of lemonade. We have to take lemons and we have to cure scurvy. And I think that if we start working on taking where you sit today and the work that you're doing today and realizing how important it is, and then looking at the work you're doing today and looking at all the barriers you're facing to success, and then open up your aperture to consider where might there be some other efforts within the federal family of trying to get to the same place that you are and start helping to connect the dots. And I think in that way, we will have the transformation that we need in terms of achieving healthy and sustainable communities for all people. So with that, I am done.